Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the Trump administration's tax reform plan, which will primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans. Masada Dizenhaus, North American Organizing Director with the climate group 350.org, who explains why her organization and others oppose California's recently passed cap-and-trade legislation. And Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who discusses growing opposition to the proposed Israel Anti-Boycott Act in the U.S. Congress and what opponents are doing to advocate the bill's defeat. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Even as North Korea escalates its nuclear weapons and missile testing program, the nation is approaching its worst famine in 16 years. A new report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has raised alarm about a spring drought which could slash food production 30% this year. The food gap could be filled by increased imports or additional humanitarian aid, but neighbors, including South Korea, are hesitant to offer aid to Pyongyang since the government has violated international sanctions over its ongoing nuclear weapons development. Despite these sanctions, the North's economy has grown in recent years, and the hardline regime is in a better position to purchase food supplies. A state-run news outlet recently urged North Koreans to grow more food to overcome what it called barbaric international sanctions. In the mid-1990s, North Korea was devastated by a famine which killed an estimated 2 million people. At the time, children under 2 years of age became acutely malnourished. Today, Kim Jong-un's regime spends more heavily on its military than other nations. According to the State Department, nearly a quarter of the economy is dedicated to spending on the armed forces and conducting weapons research, far more than other big spenders like Oman, Saudi Arabia, and South Sudan. After months of threats to send federal officials to Chicago to suppress a wave of gun violence, the Trump administration has deployed 20 agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to combat the city's high murder rate. The Guardian newspaper reports that a federal gun task force for Chicago has been in the works since last fall. Acting U.S. Attorney Joel Levin called the new task force a multifaceted, cooperative effort between state and local officials. The new gun task force is expected to provide technical services such as a mobile ballistics lab for identifying and linking firearms to specific crimes. In 2016, more than 750 people were killed in Chicago, and during the campaign, Trump singled out the city as totally out of control. Yet, many of Chicago's community activists remain skeptical that the ATF task force can reduce the high murder rate. Instead, they say, federal funds would be better spent on reaching out to young people and supporting community programs aimed at deterring individuals from committing violence in the first place. Pastor Corey Brooks, who runs Project Hood, a nonprofit group in Chicago's South Side that offers training for youths looking for a way out of gang life, maintains that the new gun task force will incarcerate more people, but it definitely is not going to bring down the numbers of murders. A decade after the U.S. financial meltdown, California's housing prices are skyrocketing with monthly rents of $3,000 to $4,000 for a two-bedroom apartment in San Francisco ever more common. The statewide housing crisis has generated growing pressure on California's political leaders to create more affordable housing in a state where home ownership rates have fallen to a 70-year low. Housing investors have flooded into the Bay Area to purchase homes that can profitably be rented out. Airbnb, the online housing rental website, has exacerbated the problem where tenants are willing to pay ever higher rents, knowing that they can sublet their apartments to tourists willing to pay exorbitant daily rates. San Francisco has estimated that there are over 8,000 apartments in the city being listed on Airbnb, many of them without required permits and licenses. In response to spiking rents, Tenants are organizing across the state to confront the powerful real estate lobby, strengthen rent control laws, and push for expanded just cause eviction regulations so that landlords cannot arbitrarily jack up rents. Activists are also lobbying local community boards to mandate that developers set aside a significant percentage of affordable housing as a condition to issue new construction permits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During the 2016 presidential election campaign, Donald Trump promised to give America's beleaguered middle-class families a substantial tax cut and said he would even consider increasing taxes on the wealthy. However, earlier this spring, the Trump economic team released an outline of its tax reform proposal, which consisted of bullet points on a single printed page. While details were scarce, analysis of the tax plan found that it would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans and the billionaire and millionaire members of Trump's cabinet. While Trump has refused to release his federal tax returns, it's a safe bet that he himself, as well as his luxury real estate development company, would be primary beneficiaries of the tax reform plan. Analysis of the Trump administration's tax plan by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found that the wealthiest 1% of households would receive 61% of all Trump tax breaks and would receive an average $145,400 in 2018 alone. In contrast, the middle 20% of taxpayers would receive about 6.2% of the cuts and an average tax cut of just $730 next year. While the richest 1% would receive tax cuts equal to 6.9% of their income in 2018, the bottom 60% of taxpayers would receive tax cuts equal to just 1.2% of their income. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, senior fellow with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who discusses his group's analysis of the Trump administration's tax reform plan and what a progressive reform plan focused on reversing growing economic inequality would look like.
Trump is answering all the easy questions about tax reform and none of the hard ones, by which I mean he's proposing to sharply reduce tax rates, especially at the top, on both the personal and the corporate side, and to repeal the estate tax, to repeal the alternative minimum tax. That's the main reason that people like President Trump pay any taxes at all. But he is almost silent on the difficult question of how to pay for these reforms. You know, in a deficit environment, everyone agrees that it's important for tax cuts not to break the bank, that they, if you're going to reduce rates, you ought to look for loopholes to close, and everyone knows we certainly have these. But especially on the corporate front, which is arguably where loophole closing is most needed at this time, there's just no detail there at all. There's very general language about taking away unwarranted loopholes, but notably, none of them are identified. So it's fair to say that we're looking at sharp reductions of the taxes that the best off Americans pay and much smaller cuts in the taxes that the rest of us pay, with the result that you're looking at a very large hole in our budget deficit of about $4.8 trillion over the next 10 years.
How much detail has been provided about their proposed tax cut policy? What do we know exactly?
We know that the tax rate on pass-through income, businesses on the individual side, will go down from the current 39.6 to 15%. A huge cut that would benefit only a small number of the very best off Americans. We know the estate tax rate would go to zero, and we know that the corporate tax rate would go as low as 15%, although Trump has backpedaled on that a little bit. But and we know as well that most itemized deductions would be repealed. leaving just charitable and mortgage. So the deduction for state and local taxes would go away. We believe personal exemptions would go away as well, the exemptions that you claim for every family member on your income taxes, and that there would be a new tax break for child care, which hasn't been very well defined, but could be pretty big. The possibly unforeseen, likely unforeseen impact of that is that larger families in the middle of the income distribution could actually see tax hikes under this swap. If you don't have, if you have a lot of kids and you're losing all your personal exemptions, this could actually mean a tax hike for you. Similarly, if you live in a state where the state and local taxes are fairly high or fairly progressive, New York, California, states like that, the loss of the itemized deduction, federal itemized deduction for state taxes, could also make you into a loser under this plan. So it manages to be a very large tax cut, trillions and trillions of dollars, while simultaneously imposing some tax hikes on people who certainly are not expecting them based on the rhetoric we've heard from the administration.
The United States, over many decades, has experienced growing income inequality. And as you look at the process of tax reform, what are some of the most essential and important things that could be done with tax reform to specifically address the goal of reversing this growing economic inequality, which certainly adversely affects the majority of people in the United States?
I think a sensible starting point, a starting observation to make about our tax system is that it taxes work more heavily than wealth. We have a capital gains and dividends top tax rate that is about half the tax rate on wages. Rectifying that, treating all kinds of income the same, would be an important step toward a fairer tax system. It's a step that would allow for affordable tax reductions for middle and low income families. And it would just restore, I think, a little bit the public's faith that the tax system is an impartial thing, that it's not there to help the Mitt Romneys and the Donald Trumps of the world to avoid taxes. We really need a tax reform that simultaneously takes away these visible indicators of institutional inequality and, as a result, helps to knit together the public's trust in our institutions, in our government, in our leaders. As long as you have these symbols of opulence and inequality in our tax system, it's a lot to ask for people to trust that their leaders have their best interest in mind. So ending corporate tax breaks, meaningfully ending them, taking away the tax break for wealth over work, these are both changes that would benefit low and middle income families, that would get us closer to having something resembling a fairer tax system, and would help solve our budget deficits and our democratic distrust deficit as well.
That was Matthew Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Find links to more analysis on the proposed Trump tax plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 17th, the Democratic Party-controlled California legislature voted to extend the state's trend-setting cap-and-trade program until the year 2030. The measure would reduce greenhouse gas emissions over time by allowing companies to pay to pollute if they can't stay under the ever-tightening limits. While this system has proven an effective way to reduce various pollutants, it also means that the communities closest to the polluting industries pay the biggest price, which has split the environmental community. The California cap-and-trade bill was initiated by the state's Democratic governor, Jerry Brown, which drew support from some Republicans. Brown says he spoke with all the stakeholders, including industry, unions, agriculture, and progressive activists. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Masada Dizenhaus, the North American Organizing Director with the global climate group 350.org, based in San Diego. Here she talks about why her organization and others oppose the cap-and-trade legislation, and her view that even though California is leading the nation in many ways in responding to climate change, there's still much more that must be done.
You know, we think that the bill that passed weakens California's groundbreaking climate legislation. So this is an extension of that And we think it makes it weaker and is a giveaway to oil companies and actually threatens the state's ability to reach its greenhouse gas reduction targets. And we also think that one of the major reasons we opposed it is we consulted with the environmental justice and frontline organizations we work with. And the bill really does nothing to alleviate the impacts that disadvantaged communities throughout the state are facing from fossil fuel pollution. And in fact, takes away the ability of both the state and local air quality boards to protect those impacted communities. So that's really what our problem was. And Governor Brown did not really consult everybody on this bill. This bill is clearly the result of backroom talks with polluters instead of impacted communities. The main problem with the bill, it sets this really bad precedent where it prevents both local air quality boards and even the state's own Air Resources Board, which is the state agency that manages climate programs in California. It prevents them from putting in place greenhouse gas reduction regulations above what this bill does. It's basically a complete giveaway to oil companies because both the state air board and one of the local air boards, specifically in the Bay Area, had measures that were pending that would have required reductions in greenhouse gas pollution from refineries and other big polluters. And this bill is basically says to them, no, you can't put those in place. This bill is going to determine what's required, and no state or local air quality board can put more severe restrictions on pollution. And so the reason it's really a problem is because under cap and trade, polluters can pay for, can basically pay to pollute. And this allows them to keep doing that with impunity because it doesn't even allow the local air quality boards to say, you know what, this carbon pollution, which is both bad for the climate and bad for people's respiratory systems, you know, is bad for our community's health, and so we're going to impose this additional requirement on it. This prohibits them from doing that, and it's just a really bad precedent, and it's something that the oil industry really advocated for.
Masada Dizenhaus, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that California is one of the leading oil-producing states in the U.S. But what about gas?
Well, California is an oil-producing state. It's usually either the third or fourth, depending on the year, oil producer in the country. And we don't really produce gas except a little bit as a side product, but we do have fracking. So we frack for oil here, kind of the same way that in other parts of the country, there's fracking that's done both for oil and gas.
Governor Jerry Brown has a global reputation as Mr. Climate Change Fighter. He's been invited to speak at global forums, even though he can't officially represent the U.S. How does that comport with this series of bills he's initiated and is getting passed?
Arguably, California has the most advanced climate legislation in the country. But, you know, climate change is a massive, urgent problem, and California is just not doing enough. And so we don't want to belittle the accomplishments that California has made. It's, you know, there are some really great accomplishments, but it's just scientifically, in terms of meeting the challenges that climate change presents, it's not sufficient. And we're also concerned, honestly, about whether the climate solutions we are putting in place are working in a way to advance environmental justice. Because, as you know, communities of color, lower-income communities, often bear the brunt of the impacts of climate change and the impacts of living next door to some of these fossil fuel extraction or refineries or, you know, some of the fossil fuel infrastructure. And so we just think, you know, there's a lot of support in California. Every time Californians are polled, they really very strongly support climate action. And we think the support is there to allow the state to go even further than where it's gone. And there's a lot to address. You know, like you said, California is, you know, usually the third largest oil producer. We have fracking, and in parts of LA, we have fracking going on right next door to people's homes or schools. And California could be out there saying, you know, we're going to stop fracking and extracting as of a particular date. We also have, you know, on the one hand, we have these ambitious targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. But at the same time, We still have a Public Utilities Commission that's approving new power plants to be built, you know, new gas-burning fire power plants. We haven't quite gotten there in California. So while we applaud the efforts that California has made, we really think that there's a much bigger distance to go on both the greenhouse gas reduction front and the environmental justice front. And we want to push the state to be as strong as it can be.
That was Masada Dizenhouse, the North American Organizing Director with the global climate group 350.org. Find more analysis on California's cap-and-trade legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Forty-three U.S. senators, 29 Republicans and 14 Democrats, have co-sponsored a proposed bill that would make it a felony crime for Americans to support the international boycott against Israel for that nation's decades-long illegal occupation of Palestinian lands. The penalties attached to the legislation, called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, S-720 in the U.S. Senate and H.R. 1697 in the House, would impose a minimum civil fine of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million in 20 years in prison. The American Civil Liberties Union condemned the bill, stating, "The impacts of the legislation would be antithetical to free speech protections enshrined in the First Amendment." The ACLU also urged legislators to oppose the measure in the absence of significant revisions. The two primary sponsors of the bill, Senators Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, and Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, initially rejected the ACLU's criticism. But Cardin later said he was open to amending the legislation to address the group's concerns. Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who discusses growing opposition to the Israel Anti-Boycott Act and what opponents are doing to advocate the bill's defeat.
What the bill does is it extends and greatly expands the scope of a 1970s era law that prohibits U.S. companies from complying with the Arab League boycott of Israel. And what it does is it extends the same civil and criminal penalties to corporations that adhere to this boycott of Israel by the Arab League to U.S. persons whose actions have the effect of furthering a boycott of Israel or Israeli settlements called for by an international governmental organization. So what this law would do, if it became a law, what this bill would do, would basically have the potential to throw an individual in jail for up to 20 years for doing something, according to the ACLU, for posting on Facebook that I support the UN Human Rights Council compiling a database of Israeli settlement products, and I'm not going to do any personal business with these Israeli settlements because I don't agree with Israeli settlements. That's the draconian nature of this bill, and the fact that its authors have been caught trying to imprison U.S. persons for expressing a fundamentally First Amendment protected right to freedom of speech has caused them to obfuscate the issue a lot and claim that it doesn't pertain to individuals, but in fact a plain reading of the underlying law would suggest that individuals would be caught up in this dragnet.
The primary sponsors of this legislation, Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland and Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, have pushed back against charges by the ACLU that these civil and criminal penalties violate the First Amendment of free speech here in the United States. What can you tell us about their rationale, Cardin and Portman's rationale, for disputing the notion that this is a violation of free speech?
Well, I think Senator Cardin from Maryland, who's really the lead sponsor of this bill, is quite embarrassed because he fancies himself as part of this Democratic resistance to Trump's authoritarianism, and he's been caught red-handed by the ACLU, the premier First Amendment organization in this country, trying to put forward a bill that would penalize and severely criminalize the act of boycotting Israel. And he's trying to make all kinds of obfuscations and legal arguments that the ACLU doesn't know what it's talking about. But I would much take their interpretation of the bill over Senator Cardin, who, by the way, wrote this bill in conjunction with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and unveiled it at their annual policy conference this spring. So this bill is being put forward at the behest of Israel and its supporters in the United States, who are attempting, through various heavy-handed legislative efforts, both in Congress and at the state level, to try to quash this growing and successful global civil society movement for campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Senator Cardin has just clearly overreached, and he's clearly embarrassed by the fact that he's been called out by the ACLU on his very anti-First Amendment bill.
Josh, review for us the coalition that has been organized to oppose this anti-boycott act in the U.S. Congress. What kinds of groups have gathered together to unite to oppose this legislation?
Well, certainly this is something that our organization has viewed as a top priority since it was first introduced in March. And to be honest, it didn't get a whole lot of traction until the ACLU came out very, very forcefully several weeks ago saying that the bill was in direct violation of the First Amendment. And so since the ACLU came out with that letter, a whole host of organizations have jumped on the bandwagon in opposition to it. Move On, Credo, lots of different First Amendment rights organizations, J Street, and other organizations as well. The importance of activists attending these town hall meetings and pressing their members of Congress is that when they do so, they're finding that the crowds are with them totally. And this is having a huge demonstration effect on members of Congress who have never necessarily seen such opposition from their constituents to their policies of supporting Israel's policies of oppression toward the Palestinians.
That was Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Find more news and commentary on the Israel Anti-Boycott Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.